This is America on the Road, winner of the International Automotive Media Conference Gold Medal Award for Radio, and now in its 24th year on the air. Thanks for being with us as we bring you the latest automotive information from around the world. We're going to tell you about some super hot cars that are coming your way soon. America on the Road is brought to you by Mercury Insurance and DrivingToday.com. If you're looking to save some money, you should switch to Mercury for your auto and home insurance. Californians save an average of $670 with Mercury. So imagine how much you could save. Get a quote at mercuryinsurance.com. And with that, I'm Jack Nerad. With me is co-host Chris Teague. Chris is based in Maine. He is living in two houses. I think the top half of him lives in one house. The bottom half lives in another. Thanks for being with us, Chris.
Thank you for having me. I guess it's definitely a very privileged problem to have, but yes.
Yeah. And not two houses forever, though, right? But maybe? I don't know.
Well, we'll see how the renovation goes.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Well, we shall see. As we've heard before, you write for Forbes, Ford Authority, Driving Today, among others. And I do the same for largely the same group, not Ford Authority, but for Forbes, Driving Today, and Auto Bytel, among others, here on the left coast of the country. So we have that going for us. This week, we have a very special guest. His name is Adrian Aguirre. He is one of the key executives on the Ford Bronco program. Adrian and I took a very detailed look at the Ford Bronco Sport, really fun vehicle, when I was driving it recently. So we'll bring that interview to you. In the car review segment, Chris, what are you going to be discussing with us today?
We'll be looking at the 2021 Toyota Tundra.
Their full-size pickup truck. So that will be interesting to hear, I'm certain. It's built in Texas, I believe, in San Antonio, if I'm not mistaken. I'll be driving and talking about the 2021 Mazda CX-9. I actually won't be driving it as we're doing the podcast, but I'll be talking about my drive in it. So we'll have that. And before we do any of that, though, we're going to take a look at some automotive news. Here's a hot car, a couple of hot cars that I was alluding to a little earlier in the broadcast, and that is the 2022 Audi e-tron GT and the RS e-tron GT. Pretty hot stuff.
I agree. I love the look of the original e-tron from a couple of years ago, or maybe just a year ago. So I'm excited to see where this one goes.
Yeah, it's going to go fast. They're both going to go fast. We have that. You know, I think we have talked on the show about how electric is so good for performance vehicles, and we're seeing that, I think, just in spades in these two vehicles. The e-tron GT will have up to 522 horsepower. And that's nothing compared to the RS e-tron GT, which 637 horsepower delivered to all four of its wheels. I mean, it's kind of nutty. I mean, don't you think? I mean, it's kind of beyond belief. These vehicles that are coming to market now with more than 500 and now more than 600 horsepower. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, these are supercar numbers, even, you know, we would say supercar numbers just a few years ago, but these are supercar numbers today. I mean, these match up with some of the best, you know, and quickest cars in the market. But and all that power and torque hits right off the line. So I'm sure I've yet to ride in a Porsche Taycan or Taycan. But this is supposedly sharing some of the drivetrain components or much of the drivetrain. So I'm sure it'll be just as rowdy as that one was.
And, you know, rowdy stuff in terms of equipment level, too. The aerodynamics are just mind-blowing. 0.24 coefficient of drag. I mean, that's like a teardrop. And then 20-inch five-spoke alloy wheels. You know, I guess you're nothing without 20-inch wheels these days. Although, when you get to the RS e-tron GT, you get 21-inch wheels. It's nothing compared to my Nash, my 1926 Nash, which had 26-inch wheels. But they're not quite the same profile, I think, as these Audi performance vehicles. So I can't wait to see these. The immense amount of horsepower, 0 to 60 in something, well under 4 seconds. The top speeds aren't necessarily as high as one might guess with the amount of horsepower they have, and I think that's largely limited to electronically. I guess everything's limited electronically in these vehicles because they're electric. But we shall see what happens with these things. I'm scrolling down here on my notes on this thing to get to the prices. The e-tron GT Quattro Premium Plus is going to be a bargain at right under $100,000, $99,900. If you want the e-tron GT Quattro Prestige, $107,000. And then RS e-tron GT, $139,000, almost $140,000. So off you go. So you have an item for us, Chris, or should I soldier on here?
I do, and this is a continuation of a story that we've talked about a few times now. And so last week I brought it up, and I was very confident, and I said Hyundai and Kia are going to build electric cars, autonomous cars for Apple. And guess what happened? They are now not going to build the electric cars for Apple. Apparently there was some kerfuffle. Apple's a very private company and keeps everything very close to the vest. Apparently they took umbrage with Hyundai's announcement that this was moving forward. So with all the confidence we had last week, it took all of 48 hours or so for that to blow up.
Wow. Wow. Well, blowing up it did, but it's incredible stuff. And we'll see what happens. Let's soldier on here. Anything more to say about Apple and Kia and Hyundai?
No, I just thought it was an interesting story because they keep going back and forth, and this time it seems like it's done. So I think that was just a quick thing. It's over with, and we can move on.
Yeah, I wonder if it's over with or if this is just, we'll have to see because, you know, certainly Apple has to have some kind of manufacturing capacity and have to find it somewhere. So there's only so many opportunities. Of course, there's a lot of car companies that probably love to team up with Apple. So I guess we'll.
Yeah, Nissan is now expressing interest. So, but we'll see. Apple might as well just buy Nissan.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that's going on out there is there's so much excess production capacity that it could be literally a buyer's market if Apple wanted to come in and, like you say, purchase a car company or just make a deal with a car company. Selling vehicles with the Apple name on them seems like a ticket for success, I would think.
For a large group of consumers, yes, I would say that's probably true.
Yeah. Despite the fact that my phone won't keep a charge right now, otherwise I'm pretty satisfied. Here's a story that kind of in some ways relates to this, and it has to do with, it's a Toyota story. They are adding two battery electric vehicles. They're not saying exactly which ones, of course, because they don't announce future products except when they're announcing future products or alluding to them but not telling you about them. They're also going to announce a plug-in, and I think there's maybe an ulterior motive for this announcement. Because kind of deep down when they're talking about all of this, there's some research that they're putting out there that suggests that the greenhouse gases created by a plug-in hybrid vehicle and a battery electric model are essentially the same. And when you think about how the vehicles are used, and depending on how they're used, you could probably get there. Now, obviously, a battery electric vehicle is never going to put out carbon dioxide because it driving around. That's just not how they work, right? They're zero emission vehicles. Of course, when you count the emissions involved in charging those batteries, maybe that contributes to greenhouse gases. It certainly does. And then, so you can see that there's some trade-off between burning fuel in the vehicle, as you would in a plug-in hybrid vehicle, and probably not very much fuel there, and then not burning fuel at all in a battery electric vehicle, but burning fuel elsewhere to charge that battery electric vehicle. And then you look at the cost, total cost of ownership of a battery electric, which is significantly higher than that of a plug-in hybrid, at least according to Toyota, and that's logical that it would be so because a plug-in hybrid has a smaller battery, and that's where the big costs come from. It's an interesting little bit of analysis here. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think it is, especially from Toyota, who historically has been kind of slow or at least cautious to adopt battery electric vehicles. I think, you know, for the most part, they've stuck with hybrids and done quite well with that. But you know, having driven the Hyundai Ioniq plug-in hybrid last week, I can't, especially in Maine and areas, I'm sure there are many in the country where the infrastructure just isn't there for electric vehicles yet. And it was a good feeling to have a car that, you know, recharge when I needed to through braking and other means. But when I wasn't near a charger, I could, you know, keep driving because I have an engine to do this, a gas engine to do the same thing. So, you know, cost of ownership aside, I think it's still a long way for many people off in the future before an electric vehicle makes complete sense, or at least, you know, range anxiety doesn't take control and drive them in another direction.
Absolutely true. Here's a quick note, and then we're going to go to a break. Vintage Indy is going to return to Road America. That is good news, because this is like live racing, and which people can attend. That's going to happen on the weekend of June 17th to 20th. People are invited to attend, and it's going to be vintage racing. So we're going to see that coming up in June in Wisconsin, in Elkhart Lake, Wisconsin. So, and when we come back, we will be road testing the 2021 Toyota Tundra. Chris was driving that vehicle. And I'll be at the wheel, or at least telling you about being at the wheel, of the 2021 Mazda CX-9 midsize SUV. So stay with us for that. With Chris Teague, this is Jack Nerad with you on America on the Road. Welcome back, everybody, to America on the Road. Jack Nerad with you, along with Chris Teague, and we're so glad you're with us. We really do appreciate you joining us on America on the Road, staying with us on America on the Road. If you'd like the program, please let others know about us. We'd love to talk to them as well as talking to you, and I think we could have some fun doing that. It is road test time here on the show, and Chris, you were driving a vehicle built in Texas. Not necessarily intuitive that it would be built in Texas, but it is. It's the Toyota Tundra full-size pickup truck. Tell us about it.
That's right. I was driving the Toyota Tundra. I jumped right out of the Ram TRX that we talked about last week and jumped right into the Toyota Tundra, and I have to tell you, if there's any vehicle that can make a Tundra feel small, it's the Ram TRX. The Tundra is quite a beefy pickup truck in its own right. So Toyota sent me just the SR5 trim. They didn't send me the range topping, was it the 1796 Heritage or Edition? Or 1794?
Yeah, I think it's 1794. Yeah, you added 2 years to it, yeah.
Regardless of the year, they didn't send me the high-end package, and that's perfectly fine because I put this to work as a work truck, moving furniture, hauling things around in the snow. We've had quite a bit of bad weather over the past week, and I got to tell you, this thing is it's solid. It's reliable in the snow. There's absolutely zero issues. It's 381 horsepower, 5.7 liter V8, but through a 6-speed automatic transmission. So it's lacking several gears against the F-150 and some other trucks, but it's a very smooth transmission. The Tundra, this one, I think all of them actually, can pull up to 10,200 pounds and carry 1,730 pounds in the bed. So quite a capable truck. However, it is a little bit behind the Americans, especially on the technology and the refinement front. What do you think about that, Jack?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, it's really interesting in that the Tundra has probably the highest tech, or one of the highest tech engines in any full-size pickup truck. It's just kind of an amazing engine, 4 valves per cylinder, variable valve timing, all kinds of stuff like that. And at the same time, and maybe it's because they build so many American pickup trucks, you know, from the big three, from Ram and from Ford and from Chevrolet, from General Motors, I guess they can spread the development costs over a lot more vehicles. And so there's a wider selection, wider menu of what you can get, and the tech just seems so much better. Toyota has always been a little bit behind the curve, I think, in infotainment systems and that kind of tech. And I'm hoping it's not still holding through in the Tundra. Does it?
It's a lot smoother than it used to be, but there's still too many touches and I guess clicks, if you want to call it that, to get what you want to do done. Especially when there's a home screen. So like you plug in Apple CarPlay, for instance, it pops up on a tile in the home screen among you know, navigation and climate settings. And it's just kind of a mess. And I think that, you know, systems like Ford Sync especially is a great example where the menus are more intuitively organized, especially when you're driving the vehicle. It's easy to look over and make a change. And that's still not the case here. But I'll say that I think they're calling it Intune, and I'll say that it's a lot better than it used to be in Toyotas. But inside the Tundra, this is the SR5 trim, so cloth interior, very basic accommodations, but Pretty comfortable overall. The front seats are very flat, not a lot of support. So I think if I had one big complaint about the inside, it would be front seat comfort. Playing room in the back seat. This was the, I think they call it Crew Max. So four doors, full-size back seat. Plenty of room for the kids, the dog, and any amount of other gear and stuff that we wanted to move and haul along at the same time. So comfortable truck. Overall, again, the seats I think would be a problem on road trips, but for the short moving and utility trips I used it for, they were serviceable. Overall, I think it's a very, you know, capable truck for that'll get the job done, but it won't be as exciting as Ford F-150, especially the new Power Boost or the Raptor. Or even something from Ram, especially just the standard 1500 is light years ahead in terms of refinement and comfort, even with Toyota's 5.7-liter powertrain that's really good. So all around a solid truck. I think there are more compelling options, but you know, I've enjoyed my time with it.
Yeah. Well, fun fact, and this comes actually from our sponsor, Mercury Insurance. I was just putting together a list of the least costly vehicles to insure or trucks to insure. For Auto Bytel, and the Tundra is on that list, and the Crew Max that you were driving is on that list. So that's something to keep in mind when you go to buy a vehicle. This is not as expensive to insure as some of the others.
Good news.
Yeah. Well, there's also good news about the Mazda CX-9, and this is Mazda vehicles, of course, are favorites of car testers, right? And even their crossover SUVs are favorite of car testers, and I think there one of the reasons, especially with the CX-9, is simply its size. It's just not as big as a lot of the midsize three-row SUVs, and thus it's easier to maneuver. It just feels more active. You feel the driving dynamics are better in it. And what you're giving up is that interior space that you probably want if you're buying a three-row SUV. I mean, you wouldn't buy a three-row SUV, I don't think, for its sports car handling. You would buy it to haul stuff. And I don't know that the CX-9 is wonderful at hauling a lot of stuff or a lot of people. But at the same time, it's such a wonderfully likable vehicle. I can't give it any kind of negative review. You just have to keep that in mind when you're driving the CX-9 is it's just not as big as some of the other vehicles in its competitive set, as they say in the industry. They have overhauled the infotainment system for this model year. It has a 10.3-inch display. It still has what I would consider a fairly baffling interface. I'm not a fan of touchscreens because touchscreens, you get all kind of finger marked and fingerprinted and they look ugly and all that stuff. At the same time, it's pretty clear how you operate a touchscreen. You touch the place on the screen and there you go. With the Mazda, you have to use a controller and figure out how that works. And then just to do things like change a radio station, which I admit is kind of an archaic thing to do, is change a radio station. It takes a bit of doing. Once you know how, it's okay. But I would have thought if they were going to revamp this infotainment system, they would have gone to a more intuitive system. And, you know, I think you and I both who review cars, Chris, oftentimes the big reviewing comes about the infotainment systems and just the human vehicle interface as opposed to what's going on under the hood or how it handles, because in a lot of these vehicles, they handle just fine. The engine has terrific power, and it's the stuff inside that really makes the difference.
Yeah, I agree. You know, it's one of those things that we say the word intuitive, and a lot of people say, oh, well, it may not make much sense to them. But if you think about controlling a screen, like you said, you know, you touch it, you know where it's going to go. You intend to touch the thing that you want to activate, but with a dial or a controller that's remote, it's not always apparent which way you're supposed to turn it and all that. You know, for us, we drive a vehicle for a week or a few days sometimes and give it back, and you almost never get to build the muscle memory. But I would think that, you know, over time, somebody buys a CX-9 or any Mazda for that matter and get used to it. But I think it was the second or third press loan vehicle I ever had was a CX-9. And that was running the older version. But at that time, and you can tell me if this is different now, you could use the touchscreen when the vehicle was stationary, but not when it was moving. You had to use the rotary dial. And that became quite confusing in between those two stages.
Yeah, you can use some touchscreen functions, and then you have to use the rotary dial, and then you have to push down on the rotary dial to get some menus, as opposed to just rotating through stuff. I finally came to terms with the previous Mazda system, and I pretty much understood how that worked, and now they've changed it all up on me. So you can't teach this old dog new tricks, apparently. It's interesting that it is a fun-to-drive vehicle. It has plenty of cargo space, not the cargo space that, say, a Honda Pilot would have or something like that, or a Chevy Traverse, for that matter. But you know, swallows a lot of stuff. Very upscale interior. I think the prices are right on the CX-9 now. So it's definitely something to take a look at.
I agree. The interior, even in the lower trims, the finishes are nice. It's nice and quiet. They're fun to drive. And you're absolutely right about the reduced interior space with the third row seat, if that option is equipped. The way that the cabin sort of tapers on either side makes it a little difficult, even for kids, to kind of get in and out. So there's a trade-off there, but for me, I think the driving enjoyment overrides a little bit less space in the back, even if my kids would disagree.
Yeah. Well, and you've only got two kids, and, you know, with three, you're probably, as I do, maybe less enthusiastic about it. But this is a great vehicle. You have to know its limitations. You also have to know its pluses. It is a top safety pick plus by IIHS, the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. So, very safe vehicle as well. There are good choices, very good choices in this segment. Kia Telluride is one, Hyundai Palisade, of course. I'm still a fan of the Ford Explorer, although I think fewer people are than used to be. And Honda Passport is good, but it's getting a little aged. So a lot of good choices. The CX-9 is certainly one of them. And I think we've got two very positive vehicles, maybe not the top of each of their classes, but that's what we've got this time around. In our road test.
Sounds good.
It does sound good. And when we come back, we will be taking your listener questions. So wait for that and be back with us with Chris Teague, Jack Nerad with you, right here on America on the Road. Welcome back, everybody, to America on the Road with Chris Teague. And we're so glad Chris is back with us. He sounds like he's about 100%, maybe 98%. He banged his head the other day as he's moving from house to house. But we're glad he's back with us. This is listener question time. And not only do we ask how Chris Teague is doing, that's a question, but we also take your listener questions, and we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us by sending your question to editor@drivingtoday.com, editor@drivingtoday.com. If you'd like to send us a question, we'll answer it on an upcoming show. And Chris, I think a listener has provided you with a question. You are armed with a question. What is that question?
I am armed with a question. And the question is, what is a universal joint, Jack? Can you shed some light on that for us?
I can. I absolutely can. And a universal joint, number one, is probably not as important a part to a car as it used to be, because universal joints were, used almost universally on rear drive cars. And they're important to align the drive shaft so the drive shaft can actually drive the vehicle properly while the suspension is moving. If the engine never shifted its position in relationship to the rear end of the vehicle or the drive wheels or whatever, then you probably would not need universal joints. But since you want to have a suspension, you want to suck up some of the up and down and the potholes that you experience in Maine and in midwinter and all of that, you need U-joints at the ends of the drive shaft, because that soaks up the movement up and down and a little bit side to side that the drive shaft goes through as the rear wheels move up and down. Now, in modern cars, they use constant velocity joints or CV joints to do largely the same thing. And you really need to use CV joints, and you can't use a U-joint for that in a front drive vehicle, because you need the constant velocity aspect of it. And U-joints aren't constant velocity, but they get it done well enough that it doesn't really matter. They are X-shaped parts that are made of steel, They have a bearing cap at each end. And the driveline connects and rotates. They allow the drive shaft and driveline to connect. And basically, they connect to the back of the transmission, and then they take the drive shaft to the rear end. In the old days, that was into a solid rear axle and then out to the axles, you know, into the differential in the axle and out to the axle. You still see them a lot in pickup trucks, and they have U-joints at both ends of their drive shafts. And they also have yokes, and this allows the drive shaft a little fore and aft movement, because as you're going up and down, it also goes front to back a little bit. And again, that would, if you think about it, the drive shaft would just bind up, or really bad things would happen if they didn't have these U-joints to suck that up. You might ask the question, is maintenance necessary? What do you think, Chris? Is maintenance necessary on a U-joint?
I would assume so.
Well, yes and no. You'd be right saying either one. And there are some U-joints that are, they're called lubed for life. They're lubricated for life. They put grease in them when they're built, and you essentially can't service them at all. They're sealed. And happily, they have a long life, but when they fail, you just have to throw them away and start again. There are other U-joints, universal joints, that have grease fittings on them. And that maybe seems like the hotter tip, because you can then grease them, and potentially, if you grease them often enough and at the right times, they would last forever. But the problem is people don't do that. You know, think of the number of times you have checked your tire pressure. And, you know, something that's pretty easy, but you're probably not doing it on a monthly basis, if you're going to be honest now. Do you, Chris?
Of course I do, Jack.
Of course you do. And you floss every day, too. I'm certain of that.
Don't call my dentist.
Yeah. And so, yeah, you know, you would say grease it. It would be a good thing, but they don't get greased. And then the bearings get dry. You get metal to metal contact, and that wears them out. So you can't have them worn out. A way to tell if your U-joint is failing is if it's squeaking. There is a clunk sound when shifting. That's the big one. If you shift it from, say, reverse into drive and there is a clunk, that's me doing a clunk sound, then you know you probably have a bad U-joint, or maybe two, and you know... Typically, in a vehicle like a pickup truck or most vehicles, you're going to have two U-joints. And if you're replacing one, you should replace the other, because the other is probably going to be near failure if one is failing. And then you go off about your business. So that's probably more than you needed to know about universal joints, but they're critical, absolutely critical to making a rear drive vehicle work. And someday, if you're good or not so good, we'll tell you all about constant velocity joints. Well, and that's our listener question for this week. And when we come back, we're going to have our very in-depth interview with Adrian Aguirre. He is one of the key executives on the Ford Bronco program. We're going to be talking about the Ford Bronco Sport specifically. I had a chance to catch up with him at a recent event where I was driving the Ford Bronco Sport. A lot of off-roading going on at that time. So we'll talk to him about that and so much more. So stay with us with Chris Teague. This is Jack Nerad with you right here on America on the Road. Welcome back, everybody, to America on the Road. Jack Nerad with you, and we are outside Fraser Park, California, up in the kind of the mountains, foothills, I guess, of the mountains in Southern California, near Magic Mountain, but that's a whole different thing. With us is Adrian Aguirre. He is an absolute expert on the all-new Ford Bronco Sport. Thanks so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Well, it's great to be here, Jack. Thanks for having us.
You had me in such a great way, driving this vehicle off-road. First, the name Bronco certainly is something that the average consumer will recognize and associate with Ford Motor Company. Mm-hmm. That associated with the word sport, maybe not so much. So tell us about Bronco Sport.
Yeah, so when we started on the journey to bring back Bronco as a whole, it became obvious early on that there was room to have a family of vehicles. that it was no longer going to be just a single vehicle like it had been in the past, but there would be a family of vehicles that would cover a range of necessities that were all true to the ethos of Bronco, right? But were different. So now you've got a two-door Bronco, right? Which is probably the closest to the original, right? Two doors, short wheelbase. Then you've got four-door Bronco, right? Very much in with the times, same platform, very capable. And then we've got the growing largest market right now, the small SUV market.
Right.
And we found that we had an opportunity there to craft a vehicle that could carry the name Bronco on its back with pride and complement the family. It would be a really good starting point for that family. So at SA we came up with Bronco Sport, really, conceptually. In terms of the name, it's for us it's critical. This is a Bronco, right? So we want a name that you would always say as a whole, Bronco Sport.
Right.
Yeah, makes sense. And, you know, the Sport designation often is used these days for some kind of a smaller, more agile version of whatever, right? Yeah. So that certainly applies to this vehicle. You talked about the Bronco, and I know it's very real to you because you've been working with this project for a long time, but the Bronco is not out. The Bronco Sport is just coming out. So to a lot of our listeners, this is new news to them that this is going on. Let's dive into the Bronco Sport itself, because that is the first of the new Bronco brand to come out. Give them the high hard ones about what people should know about that vehicle.
Okay, so the Bronco Sport, as we said, is a small SUV, right? It's part of this family of vehicles that is aiming to deliver built wild capability, right, and built wild durability. So these are the major themes, right? So making sure that we have off-road capability that we went through today, we've been driving that we're delivering on all the iconic design cues of Bronco, right? There's a very clear design language that was built into the original Broncos that we're driving forward again today. And then last but not least, we're trying to connect the people that are going to use these vehicles with the wild, with the adventure, right? So it's an ongoing theme, right? A lot of us, even more so this year with COVID, they try to get back out, right? Reconnect, be out in the nature. And Bronco Sport is an amazing tool to do that.
Right. One way I've heard it described is the Bronco is for a person who enjoys the drive in and of itself, right? That is the object of having a Bronco. With the Bronco Sport, maybe the object is not exactly the drive. Certainly the drive is part of it, but the drive gets you to somewhere where you're going to kayak, you're going to mountain climb, you're going to this. Is there some validity to that?
That's exactly the case. So we found that there's in this world of humans that are looking to be in the outdoors, right, people.
You know how they are.
What is it?
I say you know how those humans are.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
They're tough to figure.
We identified that there's a particular, and we call them challenge seekers, right? So there's a subgroup of people that really are looking for the adventure in and of itself, right? And it's an adventure because they're challenging themselves, right? So that's where these activities come in, right? So you, be it mountain biking, hiking, kayaking, surfing, whatever it is, right? And they are looking for a vehicle that is going to enable them to do that. Right, so it's never going to let them down, right? That's critical. So that's standard by 4x4 and all the capability that we experience today. But then it has other features, right, that allows them to be closer. So we saw today, for example, on the back of the vehicle, right, if you're doing you're going for a run in the afternoon, many times you'll come back late in the day. And we saw that here in the mountains of California when we were doing the development. You're changing your shoes. So we put floodlights in the back that you can turn on, right? You've got light right where you need it. You're not going to leave something on the floor because you can light up the whole area. And oh, by the way, what we've also found out is that feature and many others in the vehicle are not only useful then, they're also useful day to day, right? Like if you're coming back from the supermarket late at night, it's always a problem, right? Did I leave something? Did something drop? So,
well, and I think having that focus on the use case and directing the design based on that gives you focus, right? That gives you a focus that maybe some other vehicles don't have. If they're a more generalist compact SUV, that's going to be purchased by a wide variety of people, anywhere from 20 years old to 80 years old, if they're empty nesters, probably has a different, and going to be used mostly on road, has a different mindset than the Bronco Sport.
Correct. Yeah, we have been very focused on these things, right? So ensuring that so I'm going to maybe be a little repetitive, but the capability, the design, and the adventure readiness is always there, right? And in all series, right, you've got elements of that. So we're trying to not compromise as you go into Bronco Sport. You always have a sense that you'll be able to accomplish what you're looking for.
Right. Well, it strikes me with Bronco Sport, there's no profiler model in the line. There's no front-wheel drive model. There's no inexpensive model that is stripped of all the kind of cool stuff, you know, the utilitarian stuff. Talk a bit about the mindset putting that together.
Yeah, so I think it starts maybe a step earlier, and it's at the Ford level. It's really important to talk about this. So you touched on it earlier. What we did is we really thought about, we want people to go into the dealer, right, and a Ford dealer, and you can walk, say, left or right, and on one hand, you're going to have an Escape, right? Same kind of vehicle, same size of vehicle, but it's sleek, it's urban, right? And there's a market for that, right? And on the other side, you've got Bronco Sport. More rugged, capable off-road, right? Same size. But then what we're trying to do is avoid, as you mentioned, kind of watering down either of the concepts, right? And really being very clear on what we're delivering over here on Bronco Sport. So that's how we were able to focus so clearly, right? And avoid watering down and kind of maybe getting your arms around too much.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the must-haves you think the Bronco Sport exhibits? And kind of you stood tall and said, it has to have this. Like, we're not going to have a front-wheel drive version. We're not going to have what are some of the other things that you decided not to do?
Yeah.
So, or you decided to do?
Yeah. So, for sure, 4x4, right? That was non-negotiable across the board. Another one was the overall track width of the vehicle, believe it or not, right? We stood very firmly on, for aero, right? You could have shrunk it, and many cars do, but the stance of the vehicle and its capability off-road would have been diminished. So we stood very firmly on, we have to have the right width. And another one, for example, is the roof racks. You'll see a lot of vehicles, right? The roof racks come as an option that you need to add on. So we were non-negotiable on that either, right? Every Bronco Sport has a roof racks. It's ready for this adventure.
Yeah.
Just a few feet.
And that says something when people see it, right? I mean, that's a purposeful thing that you wouldn't have if you didn't have that.
Exactly.
Vehicles. Well, walk us through powertrain and drivetrain, because I think that's important in this vehicle.
Sure. So Bronco Sport is offered with two engines. We've got a 1.5-liter three-cylinder engine, and we've got a four-cylinder 2-liter. That's the more performance version, which is only offered on the Badlands. Now, the base engine, the 1.5, is offered on the base series, the Outer Banks, and the Big Bend, right? So three series with that engine. And in all cases, we paired it with an 8-speed transmission. That 8-speed transmission then goes to central differential, right? It's going to power both front and rear axles. And something important to mention is it is able to disconnect the rear axle completely. So when you're on the road, you don't want to be hauling all that along. So it's a full disconnect, and then it's better fuel economy, and then it'll automatically engage in any mode, right? Then on the rear of the Badlands series, right, we've got a very special differential, a twin mech clutch differential. And this is very special because it allows you to go all the way from like a solid axle almost kind of a thing to managing the speed and torque on each wheel independently. And that becomes really useful in situations like driving on sand, just being off-road. It'll provide all the traction you need.
Which kind of takes us to the driving modes, and each of the variants has its own set of driving modes, but walk us through those, would you?
Sure. So we have five base drive modes, right? So you've got normal, you've got eco, slippery, sport mode, and sand. So those are the five base modes. Those are available on the 1.5. And then on top of that, we have the rock crawl and mud and ruts when you get the 2-liter. So that's the totality of the modes. Now these modes engage multiple systems in the vehicle, your brakes, your engine, your steering, right, to really coordinate and deliver different experiences that are purposely made for the situation you've picked. becomes critical off-road.
So how would sand mode differ in what it does from, say, mud and rut?
Sure. So in sand mode, right, and if you're in that kind of situation, you want the engine RPM to stay up higher, right? So it'll basically do the shifts at 4,000 RPM. It seems a little high, right? But when you want to stay on top of the sand, that becomes critical. The other thing it does is the rear differential in that mode will actually help the vehicle turn a lot more aggressively. So what it does is it almost gives you a feeling that you've got oversteer, right? That helps you turn the vehicle around in situations where otherwise you would basically keep going forward.
Yeah. Well, we did some pretty amazing things, I think, today in the off-road portion. Actually, probably more aggressive kind of stuff than I expected to do in this vehicle. Tell us a bit about what we saw today.
Yeah, so
what kind of driving we saw.
Sure. So today we went, of course. I mean, we went here to Hungary Valley off-road park, off-road recreational area, and we chose this area because it's a natural area, right? So the obstacles there are not like man-made to be perfect, right? They're imperfections, and that makes it more difficult. We went through a series of two-track trails, right? And then had a series of climbs and declines using the different elements, right? So you're getting a vehicle into three wheels as you're going up, but still able to climb instead of losing all your power through there. Then we had that very interesting climb down, right? Very steep, which we have climbed on in the past. So don't have time today to show you that, but you can definitely do that.
Right.
And then at the end, we had this sand wash, right? Going at higher speed off-road, which actually we found for this customer is something they may do more often, more than rock crawling, right? They may be on a sandy trail, getting a little bit faster. And this vehicle will allow you to have a lot of fun there, right? You will probably be able to have more fun with this vehicle than in some larger, more powerful vehicles because you've got a better center of gravity and it's a lot more manageable.
Yeah. The footprint is a nice footprint for what we did today. It makes a lot of sense for that. What are some of the features that you're really excited about? I mean, one of the features I like is the ability to store mountain bikes inside, but talk about some of those things. Talk about that, for example, and some other stuff.
Yeah, so I think the mountain bike feature is actually a combination of two things, right? It's a feature because the vehicle is designed with a sapphire roof, which means the rear of the roof is higher than the front. And it's boxy in nature, right? So that allows you that cargo space. And we have an accessory to carry the bikes. So in addition to the base vehicle, right, we have a series of accessories, one of them being the bike rack, to use what we've already provided in the vehicle as a starting point. We designed it around being able to fit a 27.5-inch large-sized mountain bike, although we have fit 29s as well, right, which we know is kind of an up-and-coming trend in the bike world. So that's one element. Along with that, of course, there's rubberized flooring on all the rear. And you can even get it available on the front second row, so the flooring can be rubberized. I'm really proud of that because it's kind of counterintuitive, right? But the first thing people go and buy most of the time when you go get a car is an all-weather mat, right? You don't want to get those carpets dirty.
Right.
So here we're kind of taking something that is really useful when you're off-road all the time, and it becomes very nice to have if it's well executed day to day, right? Because now you can really just wipe it out with a damp cloth and you're done, right? So very glad to have that. And then there's a series of storage options all throughout the vehicle. There are the seats, right? Zippered pockets. You've got under seat storage on the second row. You've got the lamps on there. So anywhere you go in the vehicle, we've tried to really give it a second thought on what would make it a nice experience to have in that position at that moment.
Right. And when you're doing something off-road, or you're overlanding, or you're doing that kind of thing, which makes sense. Another thing that's interesting about the vehicle is it's going to be certainly a dual-use vehicle. Most of the time, it's going to be used for commuting, if we ever have commuting again, those kinds of things. And it has to be appropriate for that. It struck me from our short drive on-road portion of the drive today, it was perfectly appropriate for that. But talk about that a little bit, would you?
Yeah. So it absolutely has a dual nature, right? You need to be able to do both things. So the way we've thought about this is, and I'm going to give an example, right? I'm sure you and many of your listeners own a jacket that has Gore-Tex, right? Now, Gore-Tex is a really interesting example. It was developed and designed for extreme applications, right? You're going to go out into the mountains, climb Everest, North Pole, whatever. But if you take that and you bring it back to the day-to-day, you can have something really interesting, right? You can have the security that if you're going to walk out of your car and it's raining, you're not going to get wet. You're not going to get wet. So that kind of thing is applied here as well, right? So we've taken elements that are kind of designed around the outdoors, but that become very valuable every day, right? So yeah,
most cars are driven outdoors all the time, right? They're really not inside that much.
No, they're not. Probably off-road is probably what we want to say. So, so taking that that duality, right, and it kind of brings those features and elements back into your day-to-day life, right? So the vehicle has really good qualities on the road. The footprint is good. It's very efficient space-wise, right? You can fit a lot of stuff inside because of the boxy nature of it. And because of all those other details we've done in terms of cleanability, storage, etc., it makes it very useful in your day-to-day commute or just going to supermarket, whatever.
What is the thing that most excites you about this vehicle? Is there a feature? Is it, the concept? You know, what is it about Bronco Sport that really gets you going and you think, wow, I did something good here?
You know, for me, it's the fact that I think Bronco Sport delivers the whole experience. No matter from the moment you see it to when you start driving it the first time and you experience the way it moves, it's a whole experience, right, that communicates this is a different vehicle. So the fact that we're able to pull all that together in the team, right, every team member has to give their own grain of sand to make that happen, for me is just the biggest accomplishment for the team. And
yeah, well, having driven it, I think you accomplished it well, and a great car for winter weather, among other things as well. Well, Adrian Aguirre, thanks so much for being with us. We really do appreciate the fact that you've been with us.
Thanks for the time, Jack. It's been great talking to you.
My pleasure. And stay with us, everybody. We'll be right back right here on America on the Road. And that was our interview with Adrian Aguirre. He's one of the key guys on the Ford Bronco program, talking about the Ford Bronco Sport. What an exciting vehicle that is. I can't wait to spend a whole lot of time in it, do some more off-roading in it, and just have a blast with that vehicle. It's so cool. I also want to thank a very cool guy who's with us pretty much every week, and that is Chris Teague, our Maine correspondent from the state of Maine, the snowy state of Maine, I've got to imagine right now. Thanks so much for being with us, Chris.
Thank you so much for having me, Jack. And thanks, everybody, for listening. And I will do my weekly plug for the show. If you like what you heard, go ahead and hit the subscribe button and leave us a review. It will help us go ahead and help us keep climbing the charts and get in front of more people so we can bring them along for the ride as well.
Absolutely. We would love that. We would love to have you maybe sample the podcast of some friends of ours. There's a bunch of guys down in Texas. I guessed it on their show over the past weekend. They do a show called In Wheel Time. See what they're going for there? It's not real time, but wheel time, In Wheel Time. So you might want to check that out. I think they're on YouTube and a bunch of the broadcast outlets and the podcast outlets. So look for In Wheel Time. Also look for my book, The GR Factor, Unleashing the Undeniable Power of the Golden Rule. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, bookstores across the country and around the world. So check that out. If you like our show, I think you'll probably like what I have to say in the book. So that's it for this edition of America on the Road with Chris Teague and Jack Nierad. Thanks so much for being with us. If you're looking to save some money, switch to Mercury Insurance for your home and auto insurance. Californians save an average of $670 with Mercury. So imagine how much you could save. You might not even live in California, but you probably save a bundle. Get a quote today at mercuryinsurance.com. Please join us again right here for America on the Road next week. This is Jack Nierad thanking you for being with us right here on America on the Road.